Well, let's talk a little more for the corporate folks, since we're going to have them listening too. You've got a figure in the book that really defines the site selection funnel from the initial sites when there may be, I don't know, 50 or 100 right down to picking it. So walk through that whole process so that our corporate listeners, that probably interest economic developers too, can really understand the process of getting yourself from that big list to picking the site.
So it is a funnel, Chad, and at the top of the funnel, when you're doing a site solicitation, you're trying to gather sites that meet the certain have-to-have criteria. The goal as you go through the funnel is to, as quickly as you can, reduce the number of sites based on your due diligence. And so, you know, we'll solicit sites, we'll do a desk analysis, we'll reduce those sites, we'll go visit them, we'll do various due diligence of verifying the have-to-haves, starting to look at the nice-to-haves and weighting those. But it's a process and it needs to be orchestrated, it needs to be efficient. And you can't get down toward the bottom of the funnel. You can't get down to four or five sites and find out that one of them doesn't have one of the have to haves. I mean, that's a huge mistake because your clients, your corporate clients starting to do engineering and other analysis that's costly. So getting through that funnel as quickly as you can and efficiently as you can is critical. And where I often see the mistakes in corporate site selection that's not guided is they're just looking in the wrong place. They got to start that funnel all over again. If you're trying to bring a product to market or you're trying to reduce your cost, that is not a friendly thing to have happen.
Right. Well, and I remember when I used to be an economic developer, I would get, you know, frustrated that a project would start and stop or the timeline would change. And now that I sit on the private side of the table, I see, you know, sometimes there are reasons for those. Economic developers shouldn't always, you know, assume you did something wrong or the project's weird, or, you know, sometimes they'll get a new contract that just totally changes their logistics, or they'll lose a contract. You know, stuff happens all along the way. Right. So now I see that more. Of course, as a site consultant, you want to push them, but I now see, sitting on this side of the table, I now understand how projects will just go cold and start back up and all of that kind of stuff.
Well, that's part of what I was saying earlier about the benefit of, like, you having economic development experience and then private sector experience. I mean, to me, the public sector thinks a company should know exactly what's going to happen. Tell me how many jobs, tell me how much investment, tell me your timeline. And like you say, it's dynamic. I mean, they could be introducing new technology, they have to deal with markets. So companies don't know everything. It's a bit dynamic. You want to get them as close as you can, and we work for that, but that's not always the case. Companies, on the other hand, probably need a little more understanding of the public side. There are just certain things the public can't do. It might be the right business thing, but they just can't do those things. So, and the premise of the book, as you mentioned earlier, it's the intersection of site selection and economic development. And how do you reach the optimum situation based on the needs of those two parties? And that's what it's all about.
Yeah, I hate when the states want you to fill out all these forms, like before you ever even visit, to get their proposal. And you're like, you know, that's part of what we're doing, part of our analysis. I sometimes think you guys are trying to, you know, get engaged before we've been on our first date. and the companies don't want to fill all that out when they first go around. So
they want to fill it out. They can't fill it out. And yeah, some states want you to kind of say, well, okay, the funding's approved. Well, no, the funding's not approved because we're going through a process. We need to justify the project. This is part of it.
And you got to show the board the deal to approve the funding. Right. Yeah, that's right. I want to get into the top 10 site selection mistakes for corporations, but while we're right here, are there tricks that economic developers can use to just better write an RFI that might get them in the funnel? So, I mean, you know, they get an RFI from you, their site is what it is. Have you found that a good economic developer just answers the question a different way or more thoroughly than a bad one? Or, you know, are there things they can do that will more likely give them a chance to make it into your, you know, past your first cut, so to speak?
Sure. Economic developers need to trust site selectors in terms of what they're asking for, when they need it, what the timing is. So for a site selector, it's like an onion, and you're peeling it layer by layer. And when you're approaching that economic development team, you're working on a certain layer, and that's what you need. And if you get past that layer, we'll move to the next one. So my advice to economic developers is answer the questions you're asked. There's a reason for that. Put yourself in the place of a site selector. You know, if you get 100 sites and you're not getting answers that you need for that particular time, there's no way you can evaluate it. It's tough. So answer the questions that are asked. If you come up short on something, maybe you don't have sewer to a site or water or whatever it is, don't just say no. say, not right now, but here's our solution. Here's our solution. Water, sewer, gas, other things are going to be in the have-to-have list. So show the solution to wring out the risk. And that alone is going to be a big deal. Going to help out.
All right. Mark's got the top 10 site selection mistakes. So let's just go through these. You've hit on a few, so we might not spend as much time, but just a little on each one. So number one, lack of alignment among the client team. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I mentioned it briefly. It's a question of what's driving our success in terms of the location, the demographics, the customers, the suppliers, the utility needs, the site, the growth we have to have. And if the client team isn't aligned in the beginning and they embark on a search, generally what's going to happen is somebody from the client team is going to step in later and say, hey, you didn't address X. And there you go back up that funnel again. You don't want to go back up that funnel. You want to have an organization at the top of the funnel that you're going to keep moving down in an efficient manner, addressing the have-to-haves and the nice-to-have. So that alignment's critical. There's a big list in the back of the book. Maybe we're giving away secrets, probably not. But the purpose of it is to help clients, the private sector, see how many different things they need to be thinking about before they start a project. Not, gee, I read a magazine article that it was nice here, nice there. And you'd be amazed how much of that you see.
Yeah. Well, and do you find that within a company, so when you have that alignment meeting, do you find that sometimes the CFO versus the HR manager versus the logistics person, like they'll all have kind of different ideas of what success looks like? I guess part of your alignment is getting all of them to agree to what success looks like.
And that's a real skill set I think we have. It's like a focus group and you got to get some consensus. And frankly, I think it's productive to have an exchange and maybe differing ideas as long as you get to the end in terms of the core site selection parameters. But if you don't have that discussion up front, it gets uglier and uglier the further you get through the process, you're spending money and time. So a professional site selection consultant is going to be a bit of a counselor, a psychologist, and getting there in the beginning. And yeah, there are probably going to be some sparks flying, you know, within the client team. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. And, you know, we have clients that say, well, we want to be here. And then our next question is, well, why? And they tell us why. And then we'll say, well, there's two other alternatives that might even be better. And they say, oh, you're right. You know, so that has to get done. And oftentimes when a company embarks on its own to do it, maybe it's easier for an experienced party to make that happen, or they hire somebody with bias. It just takes them to X because they have some reason they want them to be there, then it's just not good.
Right. Mistake number two you've got is not setting up a competitive project environment.
Yeah, I mean, incentives don't make deals, but they can make them a lot better. And, you know, I see situations where you may have a heavy electricity user and a corporation acting on its own selects two finalist sites, both served by the same electric utility. That's no fun. There's no room to negotiate. So whether it's between states or between railroads or between electricity providers, to me, it's always best to have options in different locations with different providers and situations. All those options have to check all the boxes. They all have to check all the boxes. If you don't set that up early, if you end up in a project and you just say we need to be here or you have the same suppliers, it's a problem.
Number three is failure to maintain confidentiality.
Well, we've all experienced this where our clients, you know, they explain how confidential the project is because, you know, their competitors can't know and this and that. And then they show up at a big meeting with their company logos on their t-shirt or on their shirts or this or that. And, you know, managing confidentiality is a real important aspect of what we do. We manage it. We coach and we manage. It just doesn't happen. And it doesn't happen just because you have an NDA, as you know. That's a nice piece of the puzzle. And you find different disciplines in your clients that really need to understand. Engineers don't need to go to a site and say, God, we really like this one better than the other one. Yeah, no, we don't need that. So confidentiality is important.
Number four is non-optimum logistics.
Well, you know, if you're a big auto supplier or a big OEM and you locate somewhere where there's a $15 a car shipping disadvantage and you're making 450,000 cars a year and the plant's going to be open for 50 years. I mean, you start to see, you know, how important that aspect can be. So logistics for many projects, not all projects, but for many projects that involve barge, rail, highway transportation, customer suppliers, critically important to understand those fundamentals early on in the process.
Do y'all do the actual logistics analysis and cost modeling, or do you have a partner you bring in, or does the client do that, or how do you actually put a cost to the logistics?
The first thing we do is we insist it's done. We can do basic logistics analysis, but complex analysis, we're going to bring in experts. The company may have experts. We'll verify that. If they don't have the expertise, we have a variety of vendors we use. I think that raises an important point, Chad, about this whole process. Part of our value in all this is not how much we know, but knowing what we don't know and bringing the parties that are the best in the country, the best in the world to address those problems for our clients. So when our clients hire us, they just know we're going to get it done. They don't care if we do it or we bring in another expert. They know that we're going to make the rational decision on their behalf to get it done as best as we can. So, yeah, we use logistics providers.
I totally understand the whole site selection process except the logistical analysis. So you made me feel better. Now we can just go hire that out if we need to. So that's I've never known how to do is figure, how much is this going to be per ton to truck it or rail it?
It's complicated. And, we do a lot of chemical projects. There's certain chemicals that are difficult to haul. There's safety issues, other issues. You need the best of the best. That's what we're selling. We're not selling to bill everybody out on our staff. We're selling to bring the best solution we can.
And number five is lack of site diligence.
Well, there are many times if companies act on their own, and often the price of a site seems to matter most. They may close on one site because it costs less than another, but they haven't done the due diligence. And by the time their development costs are figured out, their net costs are much more. Sometimes they're deal killers on sites. You get way to the bottom of the funnel and you figure out that the wetlands won't allow the layout and expansion that you really need, or there's rock, or the water table's too high and you can't do your foundations. Our customers need somebody that's thinking about that big picture, or the site selector that's thinking about that big picture, because if they don't consider those due diligence items, it's going to be a problem.
Next is limiting the search area. We kind of talked about that, so let's skip it and go to number seven. You've got selecting a site that's too small for future growth. Talk about that.
It happens all the time. Sometimes it's a kind of a geographic and cultural scenario where people from certain countries are used to less availability of land and they search for sites that are too small. But probably one of the more common problems we see in site selection is a site selected, it's too small, it doesn't anticipate future growth, and that future growth can't be accommodated. But typically in particularly big site selection projects, there's a huge investment in infrastructure up front, and that investment has to be spread across not only the initial investment but future investments. And so asking that question in the alignment at the top of the funnel about what could this be in 30 years is really important. And when that doesn't get asked and the site's too small, it's an issue.
All right, for our corporate listeners, really listen to this one. And number eight is failure to document commitments. So as you're looking around, you're going to have people offering you tax abatements or lower electric rates or this or that, but you got to get that documented. So talk about that, Mark.
Well, there have been cases when the members of the economic development community have been short with me on this point, because I want every conversation that relates to a commitment or an indication that something would be accomplished, I want it documented. It could be an email. That's fine with me, because you find at the end of a large project, if you've been working on it for 9 months, and when it comes time to develop a memorandum of understanding and final agreements, you need the list of everything that was committed to, from the naming of the road to the gas pressure to the water line size. And I find that companies that often, not all the time, that do this on their own, they're not keeping track of this stuff. And it sounded great when they heard it, but they don't capture it. And it needs to be captured in the end for the benefit of everybody. So that's a mistake.
And number nine is not understanding the true value of the incentive package. This frustrates me when I read news articles and they'll say, and I'm going to make up this, this may not be, but Toyota in Tupelo is going to get a $900 million tax credit. And I think to myself, they'll never be profitable enough to use all of that. You know, what does that really turn into? So talk about how you really got to figure out apples to apple. What is the value of the incentives you're being offered?
Yeah, that's a mistake that's often made, not understanding the value of incentives. And, you know, companies often, when they act on their own, they're going to get different proposals with all kinds of numbers in them and timeframes. And it's very important to be able to sift through all those proposed value pieces and understand, yes, can they actually use them? If so, how much can they use? When will it occur? What's the risk it won't occur? And, you know, the general timing of it. We see so many people come to us and hire us after they've been through the process themselves. And, you know, they're assuming the package is $100 million. And after you sift through it and then maybe do a net present value analysis on it, it's much less. And so there's the potential they can make a business decision without full information. And that's just a terrible, terrible thing. So we have cost models. We have that experience. We assess the risk, so on and so forth. So you're right about the big package you mentioned, and most companies don't understand how that works because when they get these proposals, they're apples, oranges, peaches, and pears, and they don't fully understand.
Yeah. And actually, when I was an economic developer in Paducah, Kentucky, we landed a deal with a real nice automotive supplier. I mean, multi-hundreds of millions of dollar year revenue, but it was still owned by one man, and he had it set up as an S-Corp LLC. So like all the money flowed back to Michigan where he lived. So he basically got nothing, but still in the paper, you know, we're giving him $25 million of tax incentives. So I will buy this book just for this one example. I mean, I wish I had read this on day one, Mark. So I want you to talk about this. You've got here example one of a site location choice creating a logistics disadvantage. And one of the things I like about this, Mark, is you write this in what I would call common sense. You don't have to be a PhD of economics to understand it, but you get into if a company's got 100 truck trips a day and each trip is disadvantaged by 150 trips based on where they are, you know, how big of a disadvantage is this going to create over time? You know, in other words, how would you overcome this? So, I mean, that's just a common sense term that you can really think about that I think is good. So one of the things I really like in here, you give case studies of potential, you don't name companies, but scenarios where a company or economic developer can play that out in their mind.
Yeah, I mean, those case studies too for corporations, Chad, I'm just trying to give examples of the cost of miscalculations, not doing that alignment, not checking the logistics, you know, not creating a competitive environment, you know, how these mistakes I've mentioned might manifest themselves.
All right. Well, as we wind down, folks, it's siteselectionperspective.com. But I got two more questions for Mark. I want him to put on his genie hat or his psychic hat. You get into this a little in the book. Number one, how do you think onshoring and reshoring will play out? Everybody's talked about it through COVID. How's all this going to play out in the future?
Well, it's going to be a gradual process. You know, I think there was a thought maybe a couple years ago with tariffs and then with supply chain issues generated by COVID, that there was going to be this massive influx into the U.S. And my prediction has been or remain that we're probably going to see more investment in the U.S. as a result of supply chain issues, as a result of increasing wages in China. But, you know, companies just don't decide to close facilities and open them. They got to go through a process. It takes time. They have to adjust their supply chain. So I think this onshoring is occurring, but I don't think it's maybe as hyped up as it was presented. I don't doubt there won't be more of it than there was, but it's going to take time and it's going to be a gradual process. That's what I'm trying to say.
My last psychic question is, how do you think the use of office space is going to change over the next decade?
Well, I think it's going to change. I think particularly with big offices, you know, 300, 500,000 people or more, there's going to be some kind of hybrid model. A number of our clients are evaluating it now. And, you know, I don't know what I predicted in the book. I think maybe we're going to need 85% of that office space, maybe not 100%. I think when companies' leases are coming up, they're going to reevaluate those leases based on what they think this equilibrium is going to be after COVID. But A lot of people got a taste of working at home and working remotely, and there are really some benefits to that to a certain extent. And I think companies are just going to rationalize what the best scenarios are, but I think it could result in a reduction of particularly large office space. Maybe that means there are going to be smaller offices developed. I mean, I just bought an office building, so, you know, I'm not thinking everything's closing down. I do think the bigger ones, though, probably going to be scaling back.
All right, folks, that is Mark Williams with Strategic Development Group. You can go find this book at siteselectionperspective.com. You can also buy it on Amazon, all the usual places. I bought it on Amazon myself and read it on my iPad. So you got all those various options that you can find it at. And the glossary is just fantastic. I mean, if you're new into economic development, you ought to buy this just for the glossary. I mean, he gets into all the things, all these, you know, word soup of stuff you're going to hear that might take you a while to understand. So I think it's worth buying just for that. So, Mark, thank you for spending some time with us today. And I'll give you the last word as we conclude.
Well, thank you, Chad. It's great to see your business and these podcasts doing so well. And I'm really interested in talking to people about this book and getting it in the hands of economic developers and corporations too. So appreciate your help with that and look forward to hearing from people and seeing you soon.
Yeah, y'all go to siteselectionperspective.com. If you're looking for it on Amazon or wherever, put in corporate site selection and economic development, a 30-year perspective. And I think some of y'all are probably going to want to buy this in bulk for your boards. I could very easily see boards and mayors also being interested in this. So if you're an economic development group with 30 or 40 folks, there's even opportunities to buy more than one book at a time. So reach out to Mark or me, either one. I'll be glad to put you in touch with him. He's one of the best. And thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Chad. Be safe. Take care.